I'd like to motion, ask for a motion for the adoption of the agenda, please.
I can do that.
Beckoner?
Chair?
Okay, all in favor?
Yay!
Okay, motion carried. Another motion for the approval of the minutes, please.
Yep.
Seconder?
Yeah, I can do that.
Okay, all in favor?
Yay!
Hey, Harry. All right, we'll proceed to the business arising from the minutes. Tom, do you want to look at that? Is that your video?
Sure. Okay, sounds good. Thanks, Jack. So, first of all, with the town, I want to say that working with the Parks Department is very great. I get full cooperation from both Lynette and the new arborist, Jason. So, attaboy on the Parks Department. And so on that, I've been keeping tabs with Lynette Twiggs, head of Parks, and so a couple of these things, she just responded back to me a couple of days ago because she knew we had this meeting coming. So the You Are Here map, the branding's still in the works, and it's probably going to be still a couple months out. And just kind of a refresher, it's the aerial photograph that we have on signposts throughout the forest indicating you are here. What we need there, and we realize, is maybe the town names, the fonts for the town names to be made larger in the next go-round. It's funny, but people do get lost in there, or, you know, sort of out of the way or something. And so that's something we thought of a while back, was to put the font larger on the adjacent streets, and maybe that'll help. But anyway, branding's still a couple months out, and I know the town has a branding exercise, like we can go in and provide comment, that kind of stuff. So anyway, that's ongoing.
Okay.
Hemsworth Tree Planting and Trail. I've got an update from Lynette, and they've ordered the trees from Streamside. They're sourcing through Streamside up at Bowser. And just a couple of days ago, the town came in and staked the 2-meter trail that goes beside Hemsworth Road and staked the locations for the trees, the hardwood trees, to go along kind of adjacent the fence and adjacent to Heritage Forest. So that's in the works. I know the town got a $25,000 grant and another $600 contribution towards that. So hopefully, well, it certainly appears as though things are moving forward. Luke, do you have anything to add to that?
No, I don't, except I'd suggest, you know, people go and just take a look at the trail alignment. We had to take some minor turns along the way, so it's not perfectly straight, and the distance from the asphalt is a bit inconsistent. The reason for that is that as you get further to the north, there's some existing storm infrastructure that we needed to kind of work around. So, yeah, take a look. I think it's going to work out really well. It's not immediate. The pathway is not immediately adjacent to the road, and there's a few reasons for that, but I think it's going to be much better for the people walking. So. Yeah, I hope everyone likes it as much as I do.
It looks great, and I think it'll keep traffic, like foot traffic, off Hemsworth Road and onto the trail, and so that's a good thing, and it looks really good. Anybody else on that?
Yeah, you bet. I had a look at the alignment as well. Looks like a great job.
Okay.
Can we move on then?
Yep. Next up, exposed soil and possible erosion by the foot traffic across Beach Creek. It looks like our efforts have worked. The windthrow branches and tops and whatnot that we use to cover up the trails has remained in place. So nobody has come along and removed that material. except over on the Sunningdale side, indeed, all of that debris was removed. But lo and behold, I went in there, I think it was about 3 weeks ago, and someone had put branches and whatnot on the start of the trail where it comes right off at Sunningdale and made actually great effort to cover it up again, and with a little bit of sleuthing discovered that it was Terry Taylor, our botanist extraordinaire. And anyway, so Terry did that, and that material is still in place. So I think it's resolved for now as far as those new trails and the off-leash dog walking and that kind of stuff. It looks good.
Okay,
new website. I've got a web designer working on it, and in fact, I was talking to Wayne yesterday, and we're getting really close. He's probably about 25 hours into this by now, and anyway, we're going to pay him $500, which is a pittance for the work that he's doing. So I had Wayne do probably a dozen websites for me over the years. And anyway, so he's volunteering hugely to get this done for us. And so it's going to be very good. And I think something that we're going to be happy with. So we're getting close. Stay tuned.
Okay.
Wheelchair access. Yep. I was just speaking with Lynette on that one. And the sign has been ordered. And it is something to the effect of wheelchair access to the open grassy area stop. So that people don't have the perception that that whole forest is wheelchair accessible. And I've got a note here from our last meeting to notify RGN Recreation, the Gardens, Berwick, Senior Center, Town Tidings posting. You know, once we get that sign up, we can let people know.
Okay.
Good?
Yep.
Okay. Reduction of fire hazard. And so the Brown Property Preservation Society, we had about 15 members out. It was a really good show. You know, what's interesting, we're getting a little bit of a younger crowd now. We've got 269, I think it is, members now, which is a lot considering the small town size that we have. And people have been asking me periodically, oh, when are we going to do something? When are we going to do a volunteer thing? And so anyway, so what we did is we took rakes and did all of the trails in the forest in 2 hours, which was pretty great. And so, just hit really heavy accumulations and just kind of flung it back, dispersed down to the forest floor where it'll readily decompose, but at least it's back from the trail edge. And it looks great also. So anyway, so the society was able to do that. Good?
Yep.
Okay, Fire Smart Buffer next to Palm Drive. Now, we could either talk about that now, or we could talk about it under new business.
Well, we might as well get it out of the way now.
Okay. So I've written two prescriptions. One is specific to the saplings along the homes on Palm Drive, and so you've all got a copy of it.
Mm-hmm.
And now the Land Conservancy has endorsed both the idea about reducing fire hazard along those homes on Palm Drive. What they're encountering more and more, I think, especially after that heat dome activity we had this summer, is this urban interface with forest is becoming much more of a concern for communities. And the one thing that Karen has come up with to add, and I need to add it to these two documents, first of all, the TLC endorses it, but she had a really good point that we need to restrict as well any tree cutting during the nesting season. Of course, the Conservation Covenant is all about maintaining it as wildlife habitat and this kind of stuff. And so that would be an easy, you know, one-liner to add to, well, both this fire ladder prescription as well as the other one that we'll get to under new business. That's kind of the background. Well, okay, well, so what has happened there is over the last, especially about the last three winters, we've had heavy winter snows, and what happens with the young saplings is they bend right over, and some of the major, larger roots snap, and the tree dies. And so some of them are okay in there. Some of them still have green tops. They've kind of bounced back, but others have their major roots have snapped, and they're leaning right over. So, God forbid there should ever be a forest fire in there. But if it was, skipping along the ground, those things are called fire ladders. All right, and that's how fire gets up into the overstory. If they creep up any kind of debris that's leaning, you know, up against trees, the fire is able to creep up and get up into the canopy. So, you know, with climate change, with global warming, where we had the heat dome this last summer, probably not going to be our last experience with that. FireSmart, which is kind of a North American standard now, they talk about a 30-meter zone to attempt to reduce the potential for fire hazard 30 meters out from any of the residential homes. So that's what that prescription is about and why. One thing, two is, and I've got this in both of these prescriptions, but it used to be that the town would have the parks guys go out with the saws, and so there would be, you know, quite a bit of communication with the guys on the chainsaws. I think what's happening now, and has been for a few years, is the work gets subcontracted out. And the problem with that is, you know, in this case, Jason, the town arborist, I spent 3 hours with Jason in the forest walking all the trails and talking about everything. I think he's really clear, but he really should be present when those guys go in to remove trees because mistakes have been happening. There was a great horned owl nest tree over on the St. Andrews side that got felled a few years ago for no reason that I could think of. More recently, this past summer, there was a key ciliated woodpecker tree that got felled, and Jason wasn't there, and he didn't want them to fall it, but it got felled. So Luke, the crew that goes in with the chainsaws, they need supervision. Comments?
So my comment would be that if council would like to ensure that there's supervision when trees are removed in the forest, then that would be a recommendation that you should make to council for them to review at the next meeting. You know, obviously there's operational cost to have someone present to observe tree falling, and so that would be a decision council, you know, would likely want to make. Is that from an operations perspective, they may have other uses for Jason during that time. So,
okay.
So, tell me, you want to make a motion to that effect?
Well, let's discuss this. And so, when I explained the situation to the TLC, it was really Karen that said, Tom, please write prescriptions for this so that we have something in writing so it's as clear as possible what needs to happen going forward. So that prescription that I wrote specific to fire ladders along the 30-meter zone of Palm Drive, there's quite a bit of detail to that. And so what we'd like to see is each of these prescriptions added to the management plan as that. And that's what the management plan is for. It's a dynamic document that gets modified. We've modified it many times between 2009 and 2015, like probably half a dozen times. What we would like to see is both of these prescriptions amended and added to the Heritage Forest Management Plan going forward. And so that would be the motion.
Okay.
Because there's quite a bit of detail in here.
Do we have a second?
I'll second that.
Okay, is there any discussion on Tom's motion? All in favor?
Oh, can I just jump in for one second? Oh,
sure.
I just wonder, a question. Is it necessary that it's the town that's supervising the work? Or could it be a representative from the Preservation Society? And also just because of 2021, can we maybe change it to a person rather than men on point number five?
Oh my God.
Whoa, Tom.
Oh, look at that.
Whoa.
Oh, yes, look at that.
I just fought with my chainsaw and then I
went to point. Good choice. Okay, so amended. Well, and the one other thing, first of all, I'd be happy to go in if I knew when they were going in. And I think that with the communication I've been having with both Lynette and Jason, I think that, the channels of communication are open. We've been texting back and forth. And it's been really great. What had happened prior to is the guys would just go in. I wouldn't know they would go in, and I'd just be walking my dog or something and just kind of bump into stuff. It's like, whoa, what's going on here? Oh, my God. Supervision, if it was the society, which would be yours truly, I'd be okay with that.
If it were to read that the town and or representatives from BPPS to supervise?
Yeah, maybe and or.
And yep. Or, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, because I realize that it is a burden, let's say. It can be a financial burden on the part of the town to have Jason, the town arborist, out there. But I might add to that, the title is arborist. Mm-hmm. Trees. What else would be more important than supervising a crew of young bucks with chainsaws going into the Heritage Forest with the Conservation Covenant as written, all about wildlife habitat and preservation, yada, yada, yada? What could possibly be more important? Other than, let's just say, trees are down over power lines or around houses or, whatever. Of course, absolutely. But guess what? The crew won't be available at that time because they'll be out working for the town, working around power lines, houses, that kind of stuff. So if it wouldn't be Jason the town arborist's job to supervise a bunch of young buck tree cutters going into the Heritage Forest, I'm not sure what would take precedent over that. I mean, I don't want to be flippant or whatever, but
right.
What's happening is the key wildlife habitat in that forest is getting chipped away bit by bit because of mistakes.
Yeah.
And actually, I think you make a good point, too. I'm trying to rethink my my amendment there. Because I had some, the town sent somebody to come and trim some trees in front of my place. And certainly, they weren't interested in working with me. They had their orders from the town. And so I could see that being a problem if somebody from the town had given them instructions to cut down a certain tree, and you were on site, Tom, telling them something differently. So
it did happen already. It was before COVID, and I happened to come home for lunch, selling real estate and stuff. And I got home, and I heard a whole bunch of chainsaws in the forest. I said, what the heck is going on over there? And I went over, and it was clean cuts, and I didn't know they were going in to cut a bunch of trees over here on the Hemsworth side. I had no discussion about that at all with the town, and asked them, what are you doing and why? And, oh, well, the town has a work order and we're here. So I was able to get a hold of Lynette and get it stopped that day. And then guess what? They had another work order for the same work the next day. Because I followed up with another phone call to Parks, and Lynette was off work. Can't think of the gal's name, but she had another work party. And so there needs to be a focus when it comes to tree removal in the heritage forest. There's been several mistakes made, and so hence written prescriptions.
Well, maybe we could leave it the way it's written, and then if there is pushback from council, then we would consider, you know, doing something different. But leave it as written that the town would supervise and see how that goes.
I'm happy to have, you know, town and or VPS. If it was clear with the, well, clean cuts is usually the guys that go out there, that if it's me that's out there and not the town, that I've got some say over, yeah, you've got this danger tree here, and I agree, because arborists and I have come out and we've painted the tree, and this is the tree to get removed, but not all these other trees next to it. And if they would listen to me, that would be great.
So are you happy with the motion as it stands, or do you want to amend your motion?
Well, I'm just wondering about, I think the motion is fine for this prescription to go to council for consideration and possible approval. But I think before we send this on, I'm happy to stay with point number two, town and or society to supervise.
Okay.
And then Anne's point in point number five, where I talk about men, persons.
Okay.
Right?
Yep.
So if I did that and then sent that back to Brandy and Luke, would that be good?
Any further comment?
That's good.
Okay, we've had the motion seconded. All in favor?
Yay.
Motion is carried.
Just on that, too, like, okay, the motion and everything, but I get a lot of comments from people, as because I'm in there practically every day, where it's when it's dry and hot in the summer, people are pretty touchy about the potential for forest fire.
Good.
And, right, and there's really just the six houses on Palm Drive that if there was a southwest wind blowing, well, that's kind of blowing right into their backyards. And just so you understand too, Luke, if you're talking to somebody, like, this wouldn't take all that long, you know, for a crew of maybe four guys. They could probably whistle through there in a couple of hours. Like, it's not a huge job, I guess. I just wanted to emphasize that.
So, Tom, just another thought on this. I'm thinking about the mechanisms here. Obviously, there has to be a work order contract left by the town for this work to be done. Would it be specified in that work order that it would be the town and or BPPF person to supervise the work? Would it be specified in the work order?
I don't know, Luke.
So just to be clear, what exactly do you see as the scope of work?
Yeah, okay. So from the gate over here on the Hemsworth side, there's, I think it's half a dozen houses along there, and then it's private property at the back corner going out to East Crescent. But just that 30-meter stretch of forest where there's a profusion, like if you walk in there, you'll see readily, you know, what it is I'm talking about. There's a whole lot of just small saplings, little guys. Well, these are 1 inchers, you know, one inch, 2 inch, you know, cedar hemlock that were growing in the understory because they're shade tolerant, that are leaning all over the place. It's just a case of very quickly with a chainsaw, zip, 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 and maybe another couple of guys following them up, or the guys with the saws go on, and then maybe another couple of guys follow up, and they just make sure that everything's down on the ground. It's not hung up where it'll dry and become kindling, but it's actually down on the ground where it's going to decompose really in a year or 2 years. Things decompose pretty quickly in there. That's all it is. It's just a whole bunch of little guys built that big around.
Okay, so just so I'm clear, I'm going to try to repeat what you're saying in a kind of concise fashion. So you're saying that you're requesting cleanup along the fringe of blown down understory for the purpose of fire safety? Is that what I'm gathering?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's pretty clear.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I do certainly think it would be important for you and or the Parks Department to be out there to make sure that everyone is clear on the scope of work, because what one person's idea of cleanup for fire safety might be entirely different than another person's concept of cleanup for fire safety. So, it would have to be done carefully. And it very well could be this is work that would actually be done by the town itself.
Okay.
Because when you go to tree falling, that's a whole different level of insurance and liability and training. So the town doesn't fall large trees anymore. So, but cleaning up brush and things like that, that's certainly within everybody's capability. So.
Okay. And so one point, that's a good point. Point number six on the prescription for fire ladders, care must be taken not to cut live regenerating saplings in the process. That's something that TLC and I talked about, where what happens is you get a crew in and they just start cutting everything. And we still got a lot of live, green, healthy, mostly hemlock and cedar understory in there. So we sure wouldn't want to cut those. It's just the dead stuff. So it would take a good conversation at the beginning of the work just to explain. It's these ones over here, but these trees are still living, so don't cut those guys.
Well, would it be possible to flag those trees to be cut or spray paint or something?
There's too many.
Okay.
It's pretty clear. Like if we went over and looked at it and I explained what it was, you'd readily see what's going on.
Okay. Okay.
Is that good, Luke?
Yeah, I think that makes sense. It's somewhat of an ambiguous job at the moment, but I think it could be clarified with some discussion back and forth. Like, so it's hard to say, yes, we can take it on, no, we can't. I think you should probably have some discussions with Lynette or Arnold or one of those staff members.
Okay, so that sounds good. And anybody that goes in there and they kind of explain what it is, they'll understand readily what it's like. It's easy.
Okay.
Okay, so I will make the changes to this and I'll send them back out to Brandy, Luke?
Yeah, sure. And I guess a follow-up question, Tom, and I'm just thinking about the scope of work again and you know, sort of your intentions and clarity on the process. Is this something that volunteers could work with the town on in some way and collaborate? You know, I'm just, the way you've described it, in my mind, I'm imagining stuff that's pretty darn small, you know, like Scotch broom's size almost, right? And volunteers take out Scotch broom all day long. Is this something that this could be done in collaboration with the town, you know, where, for example, a group of volunteers brings it out to the road and then the town comes and chips it or something like that?
It's possible. The only tricky thing is the chainsaw aspect. There's too much and they're too big, like, to be hand sawing all this stuff. So it's, you know, it's very quick chainsaw stuff. And then, as far as, I think rather than take it out to the roadside, like, cause it, you can imagine that six houses, like, it goes back quite a little ways. That'd be really difficult to carry all this stuff out. If we just get it on the ground, it's going to decompose. And I don't know about insurance or liability or, you know, whatever. I'm just always leery about people working around chainsaws because I've seen what they do and it's nasty.
Well, Tom, here's an idea for you. What about the town workers did the chainsawing and volunteers did the cutting off limbs to flatten the what has been cut down?
It's possible, but Luke, with insurance, does that work with volunteers working around chainsaws?
Likely it wouldn't be done at the same time. You know, I think what I was hearing from Cormac was that it'd be like the town goes in, does whatever it can, and then volunteers come and do the fine tuning.
Yeah, that would be a mechanism I'd suggest.
We could do that. The tricky part about that is when the guy's there with the saw, like he's there at the moment and he's moving on, he's walking forward. What often happens is, you know, you make a few cuts and then you need to make a few more cuts and maybe a couple more cuts. And like let's say it's a tall one and it needs to get cut up a little bit as opposed to just one cut, fall it, and then think that the society guys are going to get that thing on the ground easily.
I think it sounds like you should probably discuss this directly with, you know, Lednat or Tony or Arnold to pick them up with the best way to do it. I mean, it sounds like you're willing to consider some collaboration, but I'm not prepared to say this is the best way. Like, I'd like to bring them into the conversation to see what's safe and effective.
Yeah, okay. I'm sure we could get, and it's only a small handful of people that we need, you know, to go out, like maybe four of us or something. And I'm sure we could get four society people to come out.
Sure.
Okay.
All right.
Okay, memorial dedications within the Heritage Forest. That's about Scott Tanner. And so there have been a bit of an initiative to transplant a tree from maybe on the St. Andrews side. There's some candidates there underneath the power line, so they'll never be allowed to grow up. And that's where I've been getting the seedlings from, under the power line on St. Andrews or Chester. It's kind of taken a while to get, you know, the folks that are kind of interested in doing this moving, but I was texting the other day with Pat Jacobson, who's kind of the lead on this. So there was two things. One, to transplant the sapling and put it over in the grassy area somewhere. But then there was this dedication of a plaque. And What does that look like? We've never done that before. Should this be standardized? And the idea was that there'd be some examples to present to the commission to say this is what they're thinking. They sent a few options, and to my mind, they looked too large. And so just the other day, I got back to Pat and said, listen, you guys, you need to figure this out. But maybe we could transplant the tree anytime now, and I'm happy to help with that and figure out the plaque business later. Because two, they're not inexpensive, the plaque. And again, we've never done it before, and so there should be some examination of, because, you know, once you open Pandora's box, then, you know, somebody else dies and somebody else wants a plaque, and is that really what we want to do? There's benches with plaques. There's a bunch of benches in there that don't have names on them. So anyway, I've kind of left it to them to get back to us on what it is they want to do about the plaque, and do they indeed want to go transplant a tree anytime. So we'll hear more on that, I guess our next meeting's in February. So it may be that I'm reporting in February, yes, we transplanted the tree for Scott, but and now we have a clear indication of what this plaque looks like or being proposed. So here's some options or something to think about. How's that?
Okay. Any comments?
Luke, what about the plaque idea? Is that a good idea?
I think if the plaques are done in a way that they can be replaced and modified as needs change, then it's a good way to do it.
But I think they're thinking permanent. Like, you know, this plaque goes next to this tree forever.
Yeah. I'm not in love with that idea, and we discussed that at the last meeting. My concern is that over time, you know, these will deteriorate, and some future preservation society and or town will be faced with a dilemma. Do we have to continue replacing and maintaining these plaques in perpetuity? Because they'll be spread all over the place and sort of inefficiently done. If we're going to do this, my preferred option would be some centralized location for the plaques, like, you know, maybe next to the big Douglas fir slab, right, with the timeline, somewhere in there where you could have like a list of names, sort of like a donor wall, right, you know, that you see at a lot of public institutions. It's a lot easier to maintain. Keep it out of the weather, and it would last for a long time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the issue I have is it'll be yours truly that's watering these trees weekly, I might add, in the summertime, which is great. I like doing it. It does take a couple of hours. But, yeah, I can just see plaques all over that grassy area in there. And is that... I'm not in love with the idea either. This dedication wall might just be the ticket.
So what do the rest of the commissioners think of that suggestion?
Well, I came in partway through, and I like Luke's idea of having a centralized one, but I'm wondering if we couldn't just put something, even just a name at the bottom of the tree so people can find them and have a look. Is that worthwhile or is that just overkill? I mean, a tree is a tree, so.
Okay,
my feeling on that is that it's overkill, and Luke mentioned that maintaining plaques like that is going to involve some work over time. And it also is a little bit of cluttering as well, depending on how many go in over time. The idea of a central dedication wall, on the other hand, is something that a member of the community walking through, not knowing where these trees and dispersed plaques are, would actually be able to look and be much more meaningful from a public information perspective, in my view.
I'm going to throw in a couple of my two cents worth here, too. I think what's important here is the recognition of Scott's contribution to the Heritage Forest and the manner of which we do it. I think Luke's suggestion bears a lot of merit.
Yeah, I like it.
Okay, so is the society paying for this?
Was that a question to me, or was that a rhetorical question, Tom?
Well, it's kind of a rhetorical question. It's, you know, okay, so the, like, we did the stainless plaque, you know, with the people that contributed over $500 to buy the last 15 acres, and that's up there. I'm just wondering, yeah, like, you know, the, for the first time, let's say, to create some kind of a sign, there's going to be a significant cost to that with just Scott's name. And there will be a much reduced cost in the future to add another name. And so in order to get the name on the sign, do they contribute money to the town, to the society? I don't know. It seems a little sticky to me.
More information might have been needed to actually take a look at that option. And so what would it cost? What are the logistics in building something like that that could be added to over time? And if you have the information on logistics like that, then you could consider, well, how can it be paid for? But I would suggest before considering payment options or who's going to fund it, that you actually take a look at how it would be done.
I'm going to jump in with another variation of an idea that because, and Tom, you raised really good points about, you know, the long-term implications of having an ever-growing list of things. So if we sort of take an idea from the green burial kind of movement, and that is that, you know, people should be buried in things that biodegrade that aren't toxic and et cetera, et cetera. If you were to follow that same philosophy, I think you would be planting a tree with a plaque that would degrade over time with the understanding that it would never be replaced, that it would return to the forest as the tree matures. So I'm just throwing out there, if the commission is feeling poetic, that would be my recommendation.
Do you mean in addition to the centralized one?
No, this would be an alternative to that. So if they wanted to recognize Scott for a specific tree, I think I would recommend something biodegradable, you know, make it out of wood. You could even get someone to use some wood from the forest and make something artistic, and then over time that would be the tree, and the sign would disappear.
I kind of like that idea. I kind of think Scott might like that idea. I don't know what makes me say that, but I mean, like, he was a real, you know, nature kind of guy.
The thing is, how permanent do we want permanent? Because in 50 years, none of us will be here anyway. Well, most of us.
Hey, speak to yourself.
Come on.
Yeah. Well, the wood, you know, if it was just wood and it was, you know, varnished, you know, somehow not enshrined in plexiglass and in a metal case, like the 500-year, you know, Douglas Fir slab, it will eventually, you know, peter out.
Yeah, I'm leery of setting a precedent here.
That's the thing.
Because once you open that door, you've opened the door. So we need to be careful where we're going with this in terms of who pays for what.
And guess what? The grass is about 3 to 4 feet high.
Yeah.
In the summer, and I go in a few times over the summer and pull the grass out around those seedlings. I've been doing that for years. Because otherwise, you know, the grass is, it's really high. And so,
can I ask you a question? I know Pat Jacobson is involved in this. Who's the force behind this recommendation? Is there an organization that wants to do this, or is this just Pat's initiative?
She's actually proposing at their meeting this week to the Qualicum Beach Residents Association that they kick in maybe $500 towards this plaque.
Well, then subsequent to what Luke said, why not suggest to them that they assume the cost of doing the plaque, assuming on the understanding that it is biodegradable and will disappear over time?
Mm-hmm.
Is that an option?
It could be. This is the first time we've talked about this.
Yeah.
They're thinking permanent forever and ever. You know, grass, plaque, you know. I quite frankly, I think Scott would like this, the Green Bureau idea.
Yeah.
I'll propose it to Pat and see what they think.
Yeah. Because I think as a member, I don't, I'm not going to speak for the town, but I'm, you know, I'm a member of the society. And I'd be very leery of starting a precedent such as we've been discussing in terms of a permanent plaque for someone like Scott. And it's not about Scott, it's just the idea that we're opening a door that we may not want to go through.
Well, and like people like Dave Cordes passed, and you know,
yeah.
Dave was
yeah.
huge for
yeah.
Cordes.
Yeah.
So yeah, it is. We are setting precedent. So how about this? They, the Qualicum Beach Residents Association, haven't had their meeting yet.
They did yesterday.
Oh, it was. Was this brought up?
Yes.
Oh, it was.
And it was the $500 was approved, but it was approved on the basis that the Brown Preservation Society or the town granted permission. So there was the understanding that it may not happen. Right.
Okay. Well, I can follow that up with Pat and just see what. I'll explain our concern about setting precedents and forever and ever and all this kind of stuff, and propose Luke's idea on the green burial, the biodegradable wooden plaque of some description.
Would it be useful, Tom? Just this is off topic, but would it be useful for the society directors to get together and come to a conclusion on what we want to do in these circumstances?
Well, maybe. I think as a society, we're not going to want to pay for it.
Well, that's right.
And as a society, we're not going to want to maintain it.
That's right. And again, the fact that we have established a precedent really concerns me.
Mm-hmm. What about the wooden plaque, the biodegradable idea?
That's fine. I don't have a problem with that. But it's just... I guess the idea of setting a precedent, period, and irrespective of who it is, it's a concern I have.
Yeah, like it's not a burial area
no.
Over there.
Anyway, just a thought.
What about having any plaque at the base of trees be wood, so they will decompose, and then if we choose to have a centralized one, then have something more durable, you know, under protection, under cover, whatever. By the slab, you know, a list of people. So something more permanent there.
I think the idea with the green biodegradable wooden plaque is that we just do that and avoid the whole thing of who's paying
for
this other design. And we don't want to complicate this.
No.
Okay, I will get a hold of Pat. And propose the green biodegradable plaque made of wood with the understanding that it will decompose over time.
And that they will assume the cost of the plaque?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so what it is, the town calls me when the contract is up on the plaque for the benches. And so the question is always, do the society want to take on the cost to redo this plaque for John or Jane Doe? And I always say, well, no. I mean, that's not what our money's for.
Yeah.
If we pay for the signage and stuff, but not plaques for people.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
New business?
Yeah. New business. Okay, so in discussion with Lynette, so what they've done is on the town parks department has done the Hemsworth Trail, done a beautiful job of what happened with COVID is we had such an increase in traffic that the trail got compressed, compacted, and the exposed routes became, you know, quite prevalent. People were complaining to the town about trip hazards. Excuse me. So the town put gravel over the entire Hemsworth Trail, compacted it with a compactor, and then put wooden chips over the top as per the covenant. Keep it natural, that kind of stuff. Looks great, absolutely great. The other thing is the fire access road. The town brought a load of gravel in and filled all the low spots. Especially there was this large low area at the kiosk, the 500-year timeline there. That's all filled in. And I've been going over to check it after the monsoon rainfall we've been having. And it's working great. We don't have these huge puddles in this kind of stuff.
Okay.
And the town replaced the culverts kind of by the thickest spruce sign. It was plugged and the water was running over the trail, and the town upgraded that culvert as well over the summer. So that's great.
Okay.
What's on the list right now is there's the East Crescent Trail has significant exposed routes. Lynette's aware of it. It's on their list to do the gravel. The town's been having issue finding chips. I'm not sure why that is, but anyway, it's been an issue finding enough chips, but it's on the work schedule for the Parks Department to do that. So that's happening. And there's a couple of trees that I've been in looking at with Jason, the town arborist. Clean cut the last time they were in. They did some work, but there's still a couple more, and they're over on the St. Andrew side for them to do, and Jason is well aware of that. And then I'll wait on this garbage dump location. I see we've got that at E. I think that's good.
All right.
Okay, Old Growth Douglas Fir Slab display at the Quality Beach Museum. Well, here's an interesting one. I've been doing a bit of gardening over there, helping them out. And anyway, it came up in conversation over there with Natanya. There's two more large Old Growth Douglas Fir Slabs that we cut in July of 2008, all dried out. They were in the barn. They're up at the fire hall. There's an opportunity there to do some work on the slab and to mount it at the museum. And therefore, the museum would kick in $500. The society, we just had a director's meeting last week. We've approved $500. But the motion would be for the town to agree to work up one of the remaining Douglas Fir slabs. And a little bit on that, there's no other trees around Quality Beach of that size. This is kind of the last kick at the can to have an opportunity to work with something that large. and the museum totally gets that. What it would take, Luke, is probably not epoxy, I don't know, but Brian's the guy over in Public Works. He would know, but it needs to be banded. Somehow the wood preserves because it would be outside. They don't have room inside. It'd be outside, maybe partially undercover. There is a wooden structure over there with benches. In my mind, that would be a perfect place. So some kind of a varnish or some kind of thing to preserve the wood and tipped up so if there is some rain, to let the rain fall off. And the society directors agreed to the $500 with the idea that Brown Property Preservation Society Heritage Forest goes on the bottom of the slabs so that people know where did this thing come from. Any discussion? Anybody?
It sounds good. It sounds like another resource for the community. And their name should be on it, because if they're funding it, then the name, you know, should be there.
It's pretty cool. I see people looking at that Douglas fir slab in the forest all the time. And that tree goes back to 1515. And so, you know, maybe we put a 1515 at the very center, and then maybe a 1915 at the outer edge, logged in 1915, you know, something like that, just to kind of put it into perspective. But it is pretty amazing. It's historic. It's a museum piece.
It's a great idea.
Well, has the museum thought about additional information relevant to the timeline on that log, and thinking about the history of Qualicum Beach, for example, putting in a little bit, some snippets of historical information along the timeline.
Yeah, and I spoke to Nathaniel about that, and the museum has some logging information, a little kiosk out in front of Town Hall, and so same to Nathania, I sent her the photographs of, you know, there's quite a little history to it, but yeah, Qualicum Beach was founded on logging, and in 1915, there were 85 people living here. There were 3 sawmills and a shake mill, and the railway went through Nanaimo to Courtney in 1914, and this place took off, and it was all about logging, and so I wrote a little thing, you know, to try to sell the idea to Nathania, and she totally gets that. She was kind of thinking that they had stuff inside the museum, you know, kind of to that effect. I know, like, in the walkway, you know, going up to the second floor at Town Hall, there's some really nice logging memorabilia there. Maybe there could be some, you know, not a huge story, but a couple of liner or something.
Mm-hmm.
Because really, Qualicum Beach originated on logging. That's, you know, it wasn't fishing, wasn't mining. It was logging because of the railway and for the money and whatever. But maybe a few liners.
Are there any Aboriginal kind of historical events or timelines to be included here as well?
Not really. Like, I incorporated the Qualicum First Nation timeline information. I incorporated that into the Douglas fir slab because there was some stuff there. Possibly, but, you know, not to say there couldn't be. But I think we want to keep it brief, like whatever it is, mm-hmm. on the actual slab or cookie.
Okay.
Any other discussion? Anne, what do you think of this?
I think it's great. I think it's a great opportunity to collaborate for everyone to work on a project together. And I think it's going to be discussed the town is meeting with the museum board. We have a semi-annual meeting, and so that's coming up next week. So it would be
on the 10th.
Then. Yeah.
Okay.
I do know Cortez Island, when I visited there, they have a big slab outside, and I think it might be good to look at how they've done it.
Oh, we should do a little excursion.
Yeah.
See you later. Let's all go to Cortez. Do you have any pictures?
I think I do, so I'll dig that out.
That'd be good.
And they may have one on their website or what, as well.
Okay. Were you going to look for that?
Sure, I can do that.
Okay.
Cool.
So I'd like to make a motion. Because the museum is getting together with the town on the 10th to talk about this very thing, I think we should put a motion to Mayor and Council to consider the collaboration with the Society and the Museum Society to share costs. Like we're willing to kick like 500 each, so 1,000 bucks, to prepare one of the Old Growth Douglas fir slabs for display at the museum. Tell me that effect, Brandy.
Okay, I got that.
Okay, do we have a seconder for that motion, please?
Sure, I can do that.
Any further discussion? All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Okay, motion is carried.
Now, just an add-on to all of that, there's the third slab.
Yeah.
What about getting that into the hands of the high school to prepare and have it at the school?
Why not? So when I had Jim, a little club, Jim with We Do Trees, did that for free in July of 2008, came in with his assistant and his big 36-inch bar chainsaw. And so the idea was to cut three slabs off, and thinking that we would be able to get one really good one out of it. In fact, the second one that's there is actually even better than the one that we've displayed in the forest right now. So this is actually a really good specimen. The third one is kind of iffy. I haven't seen it for a while. There has been some water in that shed. I think it's been subsequently ditched and there's some perimeter drainage put around that building and stuff now, so hopefully, you know, it's not flooding anymore. I'm not sure the condition of it, the third one, but yeah, maybe.
It's just that it otherwise it's just going to sit there out of sight ad infinitum and taking up space at the fire hall, and if the students could work on it, then they would have a bit of a vested interest in learning about it.
Okay, did you want to contact the school?
Okay, which department would I do with? Would it be like the shop department or something?
I don't know, maybe start with the principal.
Okay, and then just to ask them if they would be interested in having this available to their students for preparation?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, and then he might be able to, or he, she might be, I don't even know who the principal is now. Is anybody?
Laurie.
The principal is
Laurie Marshall.
Okay, thank you. Okay, and so just to see if they're interested in having this available to the students, and then if they are, then we can move from there and see about having somebody look at the slab and determine how it should be moved, et cetera. Yeah, okay, I can do that.
And it's in, the room has a locked door. I mean, you can get up to the building, but there is a locked door on it, so it'll be a matter of coordinating with Lynette or one of the guys to get the door unlocked if somebody from school wants to go up and have a look at it.
Okay, so this is, but it's at the fire hall, you said?
Yeah.
So the room is accessible from the outside, or do you have to go into the fire hall?
No, it's outside, and so if you come up let's see how, oh, if you come up off the end of Berwick, if you will.
Okay, you go straight up.
You go straight up the hill where you're looking at the building. The building is just straight ahead. There's some little concrete block buildings painted white, and it's the one that's just straight ahead. And then the new fire hall is off on the right, like quite a ways away.
So concrete block, is it marked in any way?
No, but if you, like, even if you're sitting at the end of Berwick and looking across at where the fire hall is, you're looking right in the door of the building.
Okay. Straight at the end of Berwick. Okay. Yeah. Sure. And I would have to get a key from the town or have somebody over there to meet them. Okay.
Yeah. Somebody to open up.
Yep. It's worth a try. I mean, I just hate to see it just sort of sit there and have people walk around it for the next 25 years.
Well, it's back in the corner, but it's just going to rot. And again, we won't get another crack at something that size. There's just, other than in the heritage forest, I can't think of another tree in Qualica Beach.
Okay. Question based on that too, though, is that maybe I shouldn't be doing this until the other one is well underway in case there's any glitches. Like, as in, if the one that's due to go to the museum, if there turns out to be a problem with that slab, we don't have plan B if I've already given it to the school. Maybe I should lay off on this until the other one's done, or at least, well, you know, underway.
Well, I tell you what, why don't maybe you and I take a run up there sometime?
Okay.
And we'll just have a look at it.
Sure. Okay.
And you and I are not going to lift the one that's on top of number three. You know, like five guys, took five of us to lift that thing. It's a forklift job. But we could certainly go up and have a look. And my concern is it might be beyond repair. It might be water damaged.
Okay, so we should have a look before I even offer it. There's not much point in offering them a bunch of rotting wood.
Yeah, so how about the two of us will go look?
Yeah, okay. Not just that, and it sounds like there's a lot going on at my house this afternoon.
Oh, no, I'm not available today, so.
Yeah.
So, all right, we'll move on. I think we've discussed item C on the agenda. Did we not, Tom?
No.
No?
No, that's the other prescription.
Oh, okay.
There's two prescriptions.
Right, okay.
And sent to you.
Yep.
Have you got page 202?
Yeah.
Okay. So this is actually, this is something else. This isn't fire ladder saplings over by the Palm Drive residence. This is something else entirely. And so, again, it's a case of no supervision when the crew goes in to drop a danger tree.
Mm.
And so, again, what has happened is the great horned owl nesting tree over on the St. Andrew side is no more. There was a small Douglas fir, a dead tree that the guys went in to, I don't know who went in, I didn't even know they were going in, went in to sell. They felled that one along with two other small diameter Douglas fir trees. But then on the other side of the trail was this gorgeous large diameter tree that had been used, not anymore, by great horned owls for nesting. Neighbors over there used to call me, "Tom, get over here quick, the chicks are out." I'd go ripping over there, and sure enough, there's great horned owl chicks up in the branches of the adjacent trees, and well, they're gone. That was a beautiful large diameter tree with you know, great big cavities in it, hollow. And the great horned owl are, you know, a fairly large bird. Well, they're not there anymore. And at the time, I talked to, I think it was Tony Batello at the time, about, geez, like, how did this ever happen? The Douglas fir tree's way over here, small diameter. I guess it was a danger tree. I don't know. Why cut this large, rare, critical, what turned out to be a great horned owl nesting tree, why did that get cut? And there was no rationale for it. And so again, and then there was the Pileated Woodpecker tree this past summer. Wasn't supposed to get cut. I painted a massive W on it in gray spray paint. W meaning wildlife. And clear cut stopped it. They felled it. Wasn't going to hit the roads. Wasn't going to be a hazard to the public. And it got felled. And when I showed Jason, he was quite concerned about how did that ever even happen. And so, again, there's no supervision. The subcontract crew, I don't know what the communication thing is, but what's happening now with Lynette and Jason is they seem to be, the three of us seem to be on the same page about let's get the society in, let's discuss the tree or the few trees that are here, let's have an understanding, and fine. It's a danger tree, it's right next to the bench, it's right on the trail, it's leaning over the trail, no question, needs to come down for public safety. But what's been happening is other things get felled in the process, and they're not just trees, they're critical wildlife habitat trees, which is in complete contravention of the Conservation Covenant. And so again, with this prescription, one of the big things is supervision.
What do you think about the idea of having something in front of those special trees, like an educational a stand with a thing on it so people can walk up to the tree and read this and go, yeah, that's a wildlife tree. So if there was something like that, first we educate the people, and secondly we educate the guys with the chainsaws. You know, obviously if a tree is labeled as a habitat tree, they should be thinking before cutting.
Well, I'm doing that now, and we've got some signage to talk about here in just in a minute. But yeah, like these, okay, so first of all, there's a whole lot of those trees. Like, they're all through the forest, right? And the young bucks going in with the chainsaws, they're not walking around necessarily, you know, spending time on the weekend with the family and kids reading signs and spending time in there. I mean, I don't know. But there's critical wildlife habitat trees all through that forest. And it would seem a simple matter for the society and the town to get together to discuss the danger tree or danger trees, come to an agreement that this is the tree that needs to get felled, and when the town and or society, because I'm happy to add that, go in to supervise the crew, then it's really clear. It's just that one over there. It's a good point you make as far as public education, and I'm trying to do that with the interpretive signage that's in there. But there's a whole lot of trees in there.
I have a suggestion. It seems that what I'm hearing is that the people that are coming in aren't familiar with the standards in the forest and the maintenance guidelines and such, and it's made worse when you have multiple contractors come in. So.
Yeah.
This is all to say that it's possible that the solution to a lot of the things you discussed today might be that there's a standing contract with a single tree service company for the forest, right? You know, in other words, that rather than using Viking one contract and then Clean Cuts and the other, and then maybe another tree service at a later date, if there was some sort of a request for proposal process and a single tree service company was identified for, say, a five-year contract, and whenever work needed to be done, they knew that they would be the one getting the call. I'm just throwing that out there as an idea because it sounds like the issue is inconsistency in the people doing the work.
It is. That's part of it. It's a good idea. And so just, from working with crews and this kind of stuff, through my forestry career, You can have a conversation with the foreman today, but tomorrow the foreman's off bidding on a job in Nanaimo, and he's got his crew out cutting trees there today, and they'll have some little verbal kind of conversation over the cell phone first thing in the morning. But meanwhile, the foreman with the education is bidding on a job in Courtney. And so there does need to be some kind of standardization, because that forest is getting chipped away at, and there's been too many mistakes made, and kind of unnecessarily so. So if there was a one contractor, because that forest is it's a sanctuary for wildlife habitat and ecological processes. That's the nub of it. And if we don't stop chipping away at the thing, you know, we're losing, you know, key habitat features. So maybe there's a contract that goes out to this company that has some pretty clear guidelines. But again, the Land Conservancy and the society are thinking that these prescriptions need to get amended to the management plan. So it's beyond a contract with a tree removal company. This is something to do with the management plan, that people need to be clear about what's supposed to happen.
It's too bad you can't add a little rider at the end, that if the company takes down a habitat tree, then that ends their contract. It voids it. They might pay attention to that.
Too bad, so sad, the tree's on the ground.
Yeah, that's true. It doesn't solve the problem of the tree.
And that's the conversations I've had with the guys when I find these things, and it's like, well, it's on the ground now. It's over. You know, it's too late.
So the only way you're going to be able to make certain that a disaster doesn't happen is to have some supervision.
Absolutely.
That's really the only way you're going to be able to secure that situation.
That's right. That's right. And I wasn't thinking about the society, but again, this doesn't happen very often, where the guys go in to drop a few trees. And I'm retired now. I live right next to the forest. So it's not an onerous thing if it was me that, you know, had to meet with us.
This activity would be initiated by the town, correct? Correct?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yep.
So what about having whoever in the town is responsible for initiating the felling up a tree get in touch with the representative of the society, i.e. you, and to be able to supervise the felling of the tree?
Okay, point number one in the prescription, initial on-site discussion should take place between the society and the town as to whether a dead tree is a hazardous danger tree to be felled.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. That's number one.
Yeah.
Because what's been happening is the crew will just go in. I don't know anything about it. Society doesn't know. All of a sudden there's trees on the ground, and they're the wrong ones.
Yeah.
So you're absolutely right, Jack. We need to be part of the process.
We need to be part of the process, yeah.
Yep.
Do you think, Luke?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's the same issue that we talked about earlier. Right.
Yep.
So if the idea is to have supervision on site, then that's the solution to both of these things.
Yeah. Okay, so I'll make some minor revisions, and we'll add person as well as men as well. We'll make sure we get that.
Yeah.
And so I'll make some revisions to these two prescriptions and then send them to Brandy.
Okay.
Now, I'd like to make a motion.
Okay.
And the motion is for council to adopt the Heritage Forest prescription for danger trees and windrow trees.
Do I have a seconder?
Okay.
Any further discussion? All in favor?
Yay.
Cool. Motion carried.
Okay, interpretive signage. So... we've got some really interesting news. Now, you've got the page with the description of fish population and the indigenous culturally modified tree, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
This is an amazing story. Have you guys read it?
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay. So, fish population. So, I'm on the board of Greenkeepers now, but about 3 or 4 weeks ago, we went into Granny Creek and Beach Creek and netted with a fish biologist under permit. So we netted coho salmon and cutthroat trout. And so this is the description. And, you know, the really amazing thing is, okay, and first of all, this is the first of 3 years to do this in-stream seine netting. So the result was fantastic. Further to this, the seine keepers netted the pond at the golf course because it had silted up, and they netted 300 fry, juvenile, and adult coho and cutthroat, 300 out of that pond at the golf course. So Beach Creek is productive in a very healthy way. And so that's a fantastic result. Mm-hmm. When you apply the math, like we measure the stream, so we hit pools, and they're about 20 meters long by 3 meters wide by on average about 20 centimeters deep. So you apply the math to the numbers of fish that you caught, and it worked out to about one fish per meter of pool or stream. That's amazing. I mean, who would have thought, Cormac?
Yeah, well, even more amazing to me is an enormous issue in our region with wild fish spawning. These are wild fish, and they are spawning in these little creeks. Very typical coho and cutthroat behavior. I was just looking at this. The report appears on mid-Vancouver Island, well, actually, Biosphere Times. There is a report on this that's being put forward by Greenkeepers, so it's available publicly. It's an astounding story for both Grandin Creek and for Beach Creek. Absolutely an astounding story.
Yeah. It's pretty great. And so, so the idea with this sign, and so the society pays for signage. We get it made up, and then the town pays for the install. And so the idea in the Heritage Forest is to have these informative signboards. This is actually an amazing story. It's so positive. And, you know, I was blown away by one fish per meter of pool and or stream. Like, you look at it. Well, and even when we're down there seine netting and stuff, you can't see the fish. Like, they're under the bank, they're in behind the logs, and they're hiding. Some of them were six inches long. You know, a lot of them were, you know, little 2-3 inch, stuff like that. But that's a very productive stream. Mm-hmm. So this is one of the signs being proposed. The other one, this took me a very long time. I must say, I've been staring at these culturally modified trees for years. And, you know, coming from the forest industry, they're a big deal. You sure as heck can't be following these things. And so anyway, I did quite a bit of research on this. This took quite a while to write this scaled down, condensed summary of what's going on in there. But there's along Beach Creek where the 500-year-old Douglas fir trees are left. If you kind of get your eye trained for what it is you're supposed to be looking for, you can see them along Beach Creek. And they're where First Nations have cut the bark off. It's very high in BTUs, produces extremely hot coal. And so forever, they were cutting bark off the old-growth Douglas fir and using it for cooking fires. Now, the coast has been clear cut. It's gone. Except for these little snippets, things like the Heritage Forest. The Heritage Forest did comprise 20% of the total coastal Douglas fir forest ecosystem on the coast, meaning in the world, 20% of the amount that is protected came from the Heritage Forest. Like, so in other words, and now since then, the government has allocated some more areas. I think it was 5 more areas, and I think it was like about 8 years ago or something. So there's more than just the 20%. But my point is, there's hardly any of these old-growth Douglas fir trees left in a coastally modified condition that have this kind of Aboriginal history attached to it. And we're walking right by it in the forest. It's amazing. So anyway, this is another sign. The question is, and I don't answer the question on here. I'd like to leave it for the people. But whether the marks, whether the cuttings were made using bone, stone, antler, or whether they were made, and that's pre-European contact, 1740s with the sea otter harvesting is when the Dutch and the English and the Russians started trading with First Nations. And at that time, they were trading iron chisels, which are only about 3 inches wide and long. They were trading those in the 1740s, and they made very distinctive, 3 or 4 inch long cuts, curves, or perhaps in the late 1700s, Captain Cook and the boys showed up, but they were still trading iron in those days, and those were wedges. I went through ship's manifests and all kinds of material to come up with this story. Or by the mid-1850s, that's when steel arrived. That's when steel axes arrived. And they left, very long, very straight cuts. So the question is, what were those marks made from in the tree? You tell me. Anyway, there's a beauty. There's 3 in particular that are completely visible from next to the trail. And once people get an idea, I've explained this to people in the forest, they're just kind of, gobsmacked. Oh my God. I had, the head of Nature Canada and BC Nature and a group in that were here to look at the French Creek Estuary and the Hamilton Marsh. This was, about 3 weeks ago. Took them on a walk at the end of their day, and they were completely blown away by what we've done with the Heritage Forest, with the whole works, and then this particular tree that's right next to the trail. Absolutely incredible. To kind of add a little extra, some of the cut marks, and I won't say what I think as far as how they were made, but lo and behold, some of the cut marks have black charcoal on them. So in other words, the bark was harvested, a ground fire, which only burnt up about 20 feet through a whole bunch of the trees that were old veterans, ground fire rolled through, and then logging came through sometime during the decade of the 1910s. What a story. I mean, that gets my juices going. I don't know about you guys, but... It's living archaeology.
Mm-hmm.
Right there. Is that cool or what?
That's pretty cool. So is this something the museum might be interested in as a story as well?
Maybe. But anyway, I tried to kind of boil this down. And it's kind of a longer story, and so it would be somewhat of a larger sign, but this kind of history is completely rare on the coast. Right now, the Cowichan Band, they have a couple of these trees, and they're keeping them secret. They won't even disclose where they are. But some ecologists have been in there. I read some stuff from them. The First Nations took them in and showed them. But, man, this is really scarce stuff. And the one tree that I'm proposing to put the sign next to is right on the backside of the Loop Trail. It's right on the trail. It's right next to the trail. Actually, it's just right there. Amazing.
I think it's a great idea to sign that, and I also think we need to put Tom in the museum, but he's the guy with all the information.
No.
I was just going to jump in, and I wondered if it would be appropriate to maybe have a conversation with our First Nations prior to having the sign printed, just to get their feedback or input, or just to have that conversation.
I'm happy to contact Michael.
Yeah.
I know him.
Great.
And propose that we go for a walk.
Yeah.
You might add to your knowledge. You might find something else that you didn't know about.
Absolutely. Okay, I'll do that.
Okay.
Motion is okay because the society pays for the sign, we're okay with that. We've got money for that. But the town needs to install. So in the past, when we proposed these kind of interpretive signs, we put a motion to council to okay the funding to do the install. That's the motion.
So that's your motion?
Yeah.
Seconder?
I can do that.
Okay. Any further discussion? All in favor?
Aye. Yay.
Motion carried. Moving on to the cleanup of garbage dumps.
Okay. So lo and behold, somebody is, I think they're looking for old bottles, old antique bottles. But when you walk in off the end of Hoy Lake, there's the trail into the forest that's right there. And if you just go straight off the end of that trail into the forest, if you look down over the bank a little bit, it's close to where the firewood cutting tree was last year. Anyway, somebody has been digging the soil back. There's quite a large old garbage dump site. And it probably goes back to Colonel Money and the guys. Like, it's really old. And they've excavated a lot of metal and broken glass. That's all that's left. But then they actually displayed it over tree logs and you know, made displays of the garbage, which I really didn't understand. I don't understand why somebody would do that, thinking that, like, that's pretty or good or, I just don't understand that. But anyway, Joanne Moger lives across the street, and she's one of our society directors, and Joanne's gone in and had a look at it, and she was quite appalled. I spoke to Lynette about it with Parks, and if the society would clean it up, and I'm thinking it's metal in one bag, glass in another bag, or, you know, however we do that, and then the town will come and pick it up. But anyway, I just thought you should know that that's happened, and once we get it cleaned up, we'll have to take rakes in and kind of cover it up again with debris and soil and moss and that kind of stuff.
So maybe we get a work party going on that sometime in the future?
Yeah, and it would be a really small, small group of people.
Yep. Okay.
Anyway.
Well, just one final thought here, Tom. Again, thinking in terms of his town history and whatnot. Is there any heritage or historical value to any of this garbage?
Well, good point. It's garbage. It's interesting though. I mean, I went through a bunch of it, and it's quite good quality porcelain plates that are all broken up, you know, shards, and I couldn't see anything worthwhile. And the only thing I could think of that anybody would be going through this is looking for old antique bottles and stuff like that. But it's junk. It's broken up stuff.
Okay, just thought I'd ask the question.
Yeah, no,
one man's treasure, right?
Yeah, right.
No, but to stack it up, like to display, I don't understand that. Anyway,
mm-hmm.
Who knows? Okay, Lyle the Owl.
Yeah.
That's kind of a fun one. So RDN has a program called the Story Walk, and what we tried to do was get something going for Halloween. And so what they do, this is a little kid, like a preschool kind of a kid, or, you know, kindergarten age kid kind of a initiative. But what they do is, or what is being done on November 8th is, and I sent the link to the Wild the Owl. I don't know if you guys have that, but it's a storybook. So I proposed after we missed Halloween, the gal with RDN said, well, you know, could I think of any kind of a topic? I said, yeah, owl, thinking about Halloween. And so anyway, this is the story, Wild the Owl. And so what they do is, it's plexiglass. It's like one page out of the book. It's mounted on one of those wire frame kind of things that they just stick into the ground. This is temporary. This is for the month of November. And the idea is, the families get notified. I don't know exactly how they do that. But then the kids will walk through and read one page of the book and then walk up further, one page of the book. And meanwhile,
wow.
Isn't that neat?
It's wonderful.
Yep.
So anyway, that's November 8th, and Lynette is coming out, and so we're going to put the signs up, and we'll have replacements if anybody does come along and, you know, take something, we'll have some replacement signs as well.
What time on November 8th, Tom?
Let's see. 9:30. Do you want to meet us?
Well, I have to look at my calendar, but I will be there if I'm available. Where's everyone meeting?
East Crescent Gate.
Okay.
It's a fun thing.
Okay, if I can be there, I'll be there.
Okay. Super.
Yep.
There's another initiative that RDN has, and they spoke to me about, and it's called Happy Feet, and that's for seniors. And Happy Feet, isn't that cute? And so anyway, she was talking to me about, you know, giving Happy Feet tours in the forest. I don't know. We'll see about that one. We'll do the Wild the Owl for now.
Okay. All right. Okay. Are we able to move on now?
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Any comments? You've all got the item number 5 there, status of the recommendation of the council and all that. Any comments on any of that? Any discussion?
Yeah.
Okay. So
one thing.
Yep.
One thing. So I do get challenged occasionally, and Luke, this is maybe for you, but I do get challenged. There's one individual in particular who loves to tell me that the forest is dying, it's not regenerating, it's a mess. And nothing could be further from the truth. there's always mortality, tree mortality. That's natural. Whether the trees blow down, they just reach old age and die, or root rot, especially on the fire access road, there's naturally occurring root rot. It attacks Douglas fir, and some trees will die. But in the understory is a really nice complement of hemlock and cedar that are shade tolerant, that grow up in the understory. That is a healthy, natural, well-balanced forest. Just thought I'd say that because I had another one of those conversations just the other day.
Hmm. Okay. If there's nothing further, I'll call for a motion of adjournment.
Okay. Call for motion to adjourn.
Seconder? Do we have a seconder?
Sure.
All right. All in favor?
Yay.
Gary. Thanks, everyone.